everyone, to the current, I'm not even sure what number we're on, to the current episode of Mention and Dispatches here at Season 6, rumbling on. The co-host has returned. Mike is back. Howdy, Mike.
I am back. It's been at least a week and a half.
Yeah, something like that. Well, the last episode was the one that had no Dragoon regulars on it, because the whole point was to get some people who had done online conventions that weren't ours, and so that's how we ended up with our new friend Chris over in Manchester on the call at 2 o'clock his time, 2 a.m. his time, which is insane. Really appreciate him doing that, but that was nuts. Also back with us and the inspiration for tonight's episode, our buddy Aardwolf is back. Howdy, Gary.
How's it going?
Hey, doing great. But before we get too far into the current topic that we're going to tackle for tonight, and we're going to let Gary introduce it, because this was kind of all his fault anyway. Gary, I am curious, what's the next game hitting your table that you're going to be playing? Not like an unboxing video or a flip through a rule book kind of thing, but what's the next one you're actually slinging dice over?
I'm trying to get Barbarossa Crimea to actually get played. It is actually on a table now, and I just haven't gotten as far as doing the actual setup.
Are you
so that is the plan
through it, or do you have somebody lined up to play with?
No, that's going to be a solitaire exercise. The next thing that we're probably going to play locally is probably going to be Third Winter, which is probably when Third Winter comes out, which won't be for a few months yet.
Somehow, the idea of the local group playing an OCS game is utterly unsurprising.
Of course. And bear in mind that, we only have one group happening right now because of pandemic reasons. So the other group that rotates into different games is non-functional at this moment.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. So, Mike, we know that all of your games are solo games, but what's the next one on the table? Is it continuing the Frederick II game, or do you have something else getting ready to go also?
Well, definitely continuing on with Frederick II, but I got a stack developing over here of games I want to get to. I've got Airborne over Europe. I've got OST Volume 3. I just got a stack. I think the next thing I might actually get to the table, though, is Command and Colors, the Tricorn.
Okay. CNC doesn't sufficiently narrow it down. You got to give us a specific
exactly. But that's going to be one probably with the wife. That may be a multiplayer thing.
Whoa. So who are you and where is Mike?
So so it's going to be me. It's going to be my own worst enemy with reinforcements. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Somewhere there's a joke in there about your wife being your own worst enemy.
Yeah, exactly. So.
We dragged Aardwolf into this one, and we dragged ourselves away from watching. So Mo keeps doing his Whiskey Charlie shows on Tuesday nights when we record. There was actually an interesting conversation going on there with him and Rob and Gimpy. Rob Oren is the guest tonight, and they were having an interesting conversation about sort of why they do what they do. And I'm like, you guys got to quit doing this crap on Tuesdays when we got to go record. Gary, you've been doing these Monday night counter clipping streams for this started before Christmas, right?
Yeah, just before Christmas, I think. So we're into the third month of this now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and it was all just on a lark, right? You just sit around clipping counters, you're like, screw it, I'll turn on the camera.
Yeah, and I had done that before. I had just never done it in prime time and had never done it as even an attempt to do it as a regularly scheduled event. And it turns out that on Mondays from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time, there's anywhere between 50 and 75 people that really enjoy watching me clip counters and talk. So,
well, there's some interaction there as well. I mean, there's chats going on, not just with you in the chat, but like chats between each, the people in the chat talking to each other.
Yes.
So that's cool too.
There is a social angle to it. It just didn't, it wasn't something that was obviously going to work as well as it has worked out.
Interestingly, so John Longshore is one of your regulars on your show, and he's also all over Moe's Whiskey Charlie shows on Tuesday nights, and occasionally pops in on Saturday Night Fights now and then. He probably shows up on the Wednesday Night Warfare feeds every once in a while, and I just got a question whether or not this dude even owns a television, because he's always dialing in with the war game creators, which is totally cool. Like, that's awesome that we can provide this war gaming network of entertainment. When it works out, it's kind of cool. This whole episode stemmed from one of your counterclipping chats. Give us a little bit of sort of where that inspiration came from you. You know, what we're talking about tonight and where that inspiration came from you and kind of your initial thoughts on it all.
Well, as always, the inspiration came from where inspiration always comes from Traveler. There's kind of two ways to think about this question, right? In terms of putting wargaming elements into your role-playing games and putting role-playing elements into your war game. And I kind of approached, you know, going into that chat, I approached it as the former, and what the audience expectation was very much the latter, which, you know, it was a different conversation than I thought we were going to have. But there are two sides to that, right? Are you playing a role-playing game and you want to add wargaming elements to it, or are you playing a war game and it would be fun to add role-playing elements? There's certainly a history of games that have elements of both. I'm going to point to an old GDW item called On Guard, for example, which is that a role-playing game or is that a war game? If you've looked at that game, that's a really good question. It's kind of both. There's a much more recent item called Legion of Honor from Clash of Arms, which is a card game where you are a Napoleonic officer and you are progressing that officer's career through the play of these cards. It's basically that same thing. It's a mix of the two types of game. And while that hasn't ever been really particularly popular, we've kind of had games like that for a long time. There's another game that I owned at one point, and it was so obscure, I have never seen it outside of my own copies, called Realms of the Unknown, where you're like this tribal leader, and you have to kind of build your tribe up in this unknown land, and it basically plays like an Age of Empires type of thing. And you have a player's book where you make a character who's this tribal leader, and then you have a game master book, which is basically this like Age of Empires type game where you're building your tribe up, and you have to keep inventories of grain and raw materials, and you have to advance your technology, and it's quite neat. Very, very obscure. You could find it on eBay from time to time.
I think I remember seeing an ad for that one in like Dragon Magazine or something, but I don't know that I've ever seen a physical copy of it. You know, a 4X game before the 4X term existed, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what it reads like now. Yeah. And I don't own it anymore. And it's such an interesting curiosity piece that I wish I still had it, but I don't wish I still had it to the tune of I want to go pay $80 for it off of eBay either.
If you find it for 15 bucks at a booth at Origins, then maybe, huh?
Yeah. But you know, even within the constraints of role-playing games, so you may recall, you'll recall, and a lot of the old people who played D&D in the 80s will recall that there were several D&D, like Hex Encounter War games, right? There was one for Dragonlance in one of the, I think it was DL12, if I'm not mistaken. There was an X-series module called Red Arrow Black Shield, which was
X-10.
A Hex Encounter War game in the D&D known world.
It was X-10. Mm-hmm. Yep, know it well.
And there was Greyhawk Wars, which was a standalone board game, but it was, you know, the world of Greyhawk goes to war. Not Hex Encounter. It was an area map, but still it was a war game.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a variety of Hex Encounter. There were a variety of different games over the years in some of the modules that while they were set up as sort of a set piece battle within a larger adventure, they were quite frankly one battle war games within the module itself. The one that I'm specifically thinking of is the one in B10 at the horse paddock at Sikiskin when you had the goblin attack on the ranch there. It's a big ass 24 by 36 or 18 by 24 fold out map with 80 odd counters worth of goblins running around and the heroes out there. And yeah, you could put some minis on there instead of the counters and that's fine, but you've essentially got it. It's not hexes and counters, it's squares and counters, but you're essentially fighting a war game to fight that battle with your characters. and you could just play that one battle and have a satisfying, you know, 90-minute little war game experience with a little fantasy battle and be perfectly good with that.
And there are the various miniatures rules that intersect with D&D. But, you know, going back to Chainmail, the game that D&D arose from in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the more recent version of Chainmail that they did, plus Battle System, which was an AD&D second edition product, which was miniatures rules that interlocked with the regular D&D rules for mass battles. They did the entire setting of Birthright, which played very much like a war game in a lot of ways. Certainly the battle resolution was essentially a card-based war game.
Yeah. And then there was the war machine that they introduced in the companion series games that was a really interesting twist on mass battles, because it was mass combat without the map, which was kind of a neat way to do things. It essentially aggregated your army into sort of air quote character stats, right? It made a character out of your army.
And debatably still the best RPG mass combat system.
Let's go ahead and court some controversy. I wouldn't even debate it. I would flat out state that it is the best mass combat system for RPGs, for fantasy RPGs, that is an RPG based fantasy combat system and not grafting on a war game.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. I think it's the best, without trying to be controversial here, it's the best mass combat resolution system for RPGs that isn't an actual war game inserted into the RPG, which a lot of the other ones are.
Yeah.
Battle Lust for Harnmaster is another one. But that's like, again, it's an actual war game that you're sticking in there rather than this relatively clean RPG mechanism to resolve large battles.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, again, anybody that thinks we're sitting here trying to slag on fantasy war games is barking up the wrong tree, right? I mean, we are diehard war gamers at a wargaming website with a wargaming podcast. Like, we're totally all about some war game love here, but when talking about sort of where war games and RPGs intersect, it can sometimes be cumbersome to drag out the war game to resolve the mass battle in the midst of the RPG. Days that's a perfectly fun way to kill some time.
Sometimes you don't want the war game resolution, right? Like, let's say you're playing a superhero game. Do you really want mass combat? I don't think so. Not generally.
That's how the fight at the end of Endgame takes 90 minutes.
Your average Rolemaster combat. But the I shouldn't even say that. The average Rolemaster combat is over and under 3 rounds because everybody's dead and due to various graphic injuries. But
it just takes 90 minutes to resolve them.
No, that's actually an overstatement. I'll do a thing about Rolemaster at some point, but the cumbersomeness of Rolemaster, depending on exactly which edition you're talking about, is generally overstated. It actually runs quite smoothly if everybody knows what they're doing and is organized, which is an important caveat.
Yes, yes, that is a key caveat. Mike, what do you think? Role playing mass combat intersection there. Some
I kind of clueless here because I even back when I first started playing role playing games, I'm trying to think of at least one situation or one time where anything needed to be resolved on a grand scale in a role playing game, and I can't think of one. Closest I can come is maybe Starfleet battles when we tied that into Star Trek the role playing game, but even those battles were small, so yeah, not much help.
Not a lot of fleet actions there, huh?
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's actually a fascinating thing that you've just mentioned, because that is one way to, let's say you're playing a Star Trek role playing game. This is the best example of this that I can think of. Well, you can, you know, use Star Trek combat systems to resolve a starship battle if you want. You could use Starfleet battles. You could use that new Star Trek miniatures thing, whatever it's called. But if you remember, the old FOSS of Star Trek had a really, really fascinating starship combat system that gave everybody, you know, kind of based on the assumption that your group was the bridge crew, it gave everybody something to do. The communications officer had something to do. The chief engineer had something to do during that combat system. And that was actually probably one of the more interesting integrations of wargame ideas into reintegration, I suppose, into an RPG that I've seen. And I don't know that I've seen anybody else really even try to do that. Not off the top of my head, anyway.
And certainly not in the later, the more recent iterations of Star Trek role-playing games. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, the current Star Trek game is Star Trek Adventures from Modiphius, which I actually have a pretty high opinion of. But if you want a meaty combat spaceship combat resolution, that's not where you're going to go.
No, it's almost like having two characters battle each other in that game. Yeah.
Gary, it's an interesting. So I can remember thumbing through the Faza Star Trek book back in the late 80s, early 90s. It would have been late 80s because it was before I got to college that I remember flipping through it, I think. But I was never a big sci-fi role-playing game guy. So it was, it was a point of curiosity. Oh, look, this is kind of cool. But I wasn't really following it, and it wasn't something that I played a bunch of. Mm-hmm. But just from your description, though, in terms of everybody has something to do, I think where you're saying you haven't really seen that much since then, I think it works well in a sci-fi context, because you've got a bunch of people inside the large vehicle that is engaged in the combat, so they all need something to do in the vehicle. I think if you're going to do something like that in a fantasy context or historical context, then you're looking at like a ship crew, right? You've got somebody manning the catapult, you've got somebody manning the sails, you got somebody steering the boat, you've got whatever else is going on your galleon or your ancient, warship, fighting Greeks versus Trojans kind of thing. But I don't know, necessarily how you would do more than that in like a giant Warhammer battle, because at that point, all of the individual characters have individual roles that they're moving all over the battlefield doing their individual things, whether it's leading some troops or doing something heroic or whatever else, that there's not a ton of teamwork necessarily required in that kind of ground setting versus everybody is in one vessel in one container together somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So you're still role playing at that point.
Yeah.
Totally. But I think that the context of put everybody in a ship, you give everybody something to do in the ship. But if you take the ship away, the everybody needs something to do becomes different. A whole different context of what you're going to have them do.
Yeah, I mean, it works in part due to the tropes of the source material in the case of Star Trek specifically. But, the same would apply to, say Traveler, for example, which has interestingly never had such a system. It has had a number of other wargame adjuncts over the years, but not that.
Yeah, which but it could have you would that, expect right? coming I mean, out of GDW.
Yeah, you kind of would, actually. It's weird, I guess, thinking about it. It's a little weird that that came out of FASA rather than GDW, that had made their business, at least the role-playing end of their business, had made, Traveler was it, right? And they not that they didn't have other games, they did, but, Traveler was always the core of the role-playing side of GDW to one extent or another. And they did, the big sort of strategic operational game of Fifth Frontier War, and they did the various man-to-man on a starship combat systems in things like Mayday and Ajanti High Lightning. They did a couple of variant starship systems, including the one in Mayday. Snapshot was the other one with Ajanti High Lightning, actually. Mayday was the starships. And in addition to the two or three different classic Traveler starship combat systems that were in the RPG, some of which were not that abstract. They did Planetary Invasion game in Invasion Earth, which you could adapt to invading other planets if you wanted to. And they had the whole grand strategic thing going on in games like Imperium and Dark Nebula. And Imperium, is that lasted the entire lifespan of GDW as a company.
Yep. And people still happily sit down at a convention and pull that one out and play it for a 6-hour game.
It's a great game. And Dark Nebula is the same game on a geomorphic map, basically.
Yeah. When folks tend to think of sort of the wargaming role-playing intersection, a lot of what immediately comes to mind are sort of military-themed RPGs. And your counter-clipping stream listed off a bunch of those, right? You've got Twilight 2000, you've got Recon, you've got, all these different ones throughout the years.
Behind Enemy Lines.
That's not the direction we were wanting to take this. in terms of the conversation. It was, like you'd said earlier on, it was sort of approaching it from that other direction. Take your war games and how, if at all, can and should you, or would you want to even try injecting role-playing elements into your war games? And I almost feel like we got to throw a bit of a caveat in here. At least I'm not. I'm pretty sure you're not, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. We're not advocating that this has to happen in every possible war game, because there's going to be some chucklehead out there that's going to like listen to this and go, damn it, you want to shove role-playing into my war game? No, no. Like, if you don't want to, then don't do it. Like, that's cool. Just
you know what, though? that exact person is probably completely fine with the types of things that I have seen at virtually every war game group that I've ever been in, which is people doing stuff like wearing funny hats. That's maybe a little more elaborate than some people get, but who plays a Battle of Britain game and doesn't bust out the Winston Churchill impression?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, nobody plays that game without a Winston Churchill impression at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where
I have been known to sing the Soviet national anthem when a good die roll occurs in OCS.
So these are the kinds of things that we're talking about in terms of what are some elements that you can bring of the role-playing world to the table in your actual war games. And one of them, you've already sort of started talking. There is the acting out of a persona within the game itself. And that's just simply grafting on a little bit of sort of dramatic license as a player around a table, inhabiting the role of supreme commander of whatever side you're on and,
right,
and being a bit of a goofball, whether it's a bad Russian accent while you're playing the Russian or a bad German accent while you're playing the Germans or pretending you're John Wayne when you're playing the Americans or whatever it may be.
Right.
So that happens, right? You occasionally get the props, right? You get the funny hats. Doug Miller showed up at Origins one year with a Russian shapka on to play, to help play the op for the command post exercises.
Yeah, I mean, how many Napoleon hats does Jim have, for example?
Apparently one. It's just a really, really nice one.
I was going to say, it's probably an authentic one that he liberated
from France. Stole from a museum.
So that is not just because I happen to know from having the conversation with Jim. That is not the case. However, it was made by someone who makes them for museums. So.
Although he does have his eye on a particular tent overseas that he would like to abscond with at some point.
Or liberate. Is the term that we want to use here.
I mean, it is French. It needs liberating. But let's not speak too much more of that, lest we get hauled onto the stand as accomplices if he is ever caught.
It's very true. Very true.
Let's maintain some plausible deniability here, guys. as I'm sure Jim would appreciate us, having the foresight to maintain said plausibility. the idea of those role-playing elements, again, Gary, obviously the simplest one of them is just sort of putting yourself in character a little bit around the table and kind of playing along a little bit, whether it's giving the speech or dressing up a little or whatever it may be.
Also, what about thinking about this? What about a game like Gunslinger, Avalon Hill's Gunslinger, or Gladiator, where you play in – I mean, the big intuitive leap between – pre-role-playing games and role-playing games was the idea that you, the player, were going to be playing this specific individual rather than a stand of units or a unit of troops represented by a counter, right? Are you going to play, a Gladiator game or a game of Circus Maximus or something like that and not, throw Ben-Hur quotes or Gladiator quotes out there? I don't think so. That's part of the fun in it. And yet that is kind of role-playing, right? I mean, it's kind of low impact role playing, admittedly, but still, it's there.
And that happened quite a bit with games of Sniper over the years.
Yeah,
Sniper and the especially once the Special Forces expansion to Sniper came out, because Sniper, if you're doing it right, you've got a whole squad of dudes, but it's just a line squad and infantry unit, and you should have other squads around you doing other things. So even though you're playing your individual dudes, it's very easy to conceptualize being tied into a larger military operation. Once the expansion came out for the Special Forces expansion, now it's you six dudes on a raid somewhere doing something really secret that you're not supposed to talk about, and that's I mean, that's really starting to skirt into role playing there a little bit. But I think for me, the way I'd always conceptualized it, and I don't want to get overly pedantic, especially not after as we are recording this, Rocky Mountain Navy's rebuttal to Herald's article about Wargamer archetypes is still sort of setting Twitter on fire at the moment. And I don't want to get overly pedantic and sort of start forcing things into definitional boxes. But for me, the point where the games crossed from being a war game into a role-playing game was the idea that the same character lived on beyond the one scenario you're playing, and not just that you carried the same person, that same character on into the next scenario, into the next game, but that you did so with the accumulated experience and wisdom gained through that series of play. And that's where I think role-playing games started to differ from war games. It wasn't just that General Lee went from battle to battle to battle. It's that General Lee got better from battle to battle to battle as he learned how to fight, to use an example. Grant's the same thing, right? Burnside went backwards. But there are different commanders out there that gained an experience. In aggregate, units that survive extended combat across a period of time should get better. That was the whole point of Napoleon's Old Guard, right? So as you move forward from game to game to game, it's not just, oh, yeah, that's, I'm playing Jones in this game of Sergeants, the Sergeants Minis game that we used to always have at Origins with the guys from Lost Battalion. I'm not just playing Jones this game. I'm going to play Jones next game, except now he's not a PFC. Now he's been promoted to corporal because he's a more competent soldier. How do I reflect that in the stats? How does that get better? And I think that's the interesting jump that I don't know that we see that often. And so, I mean, either of you, Mike, have you ever seen something like that explicitly written out in a war game as you go from scenario to scenario to scenario
with the
same folks?
When you first mentioned this topic to me, the first thing that popped into my mind, and I sought this game out because it's out of print, and I unlike Gary, I went and paid those premium prices for it. It's Battle Hymn, and the way I haven't played it yet, but the way I understand that game is it works kind of just like that, where you take a group of soldiers and they actually go through a series of scenarios, and I think they do get better and better as they go along if they survive.
Gary, what about you?
We also have they don't really improve. Well, I guess let me put it this way. In something like The Hunters, there is, a way to play that as an ongoing career of your particular U-boat captain, right? And the same thing applies to Silent Victory or whatever. But the avenues for improvement are a little bit narrower. The crew can get better. Your captain does not improve per se, although he might have the ability to requisition better stuff, like a better U-boat, for example. The crew will improve. They will go from, green to average to veteran to elite to whatever. So there's progression elements that I would also agree that progression element is a core feature of RPGs. It always has been for me. I mean, there's probably people who would differ with this, but I wouldn't. It's relatively uncommon to see it in war games. It certainly on the person-to-person level. But I wouldn't say we've never seen it. Like I said, the games that spring to mind for me that feature something like that are more things like The Hunters and stuff like that now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's some of the solo air games. Obviously, the Dan Versen leader series of games, although he's got some ground combat ones now as well. Mm-hmm. But also the ones in the B-17 Queen of the Skies series, that family of games that, you've got your aircraft crew and you slap names on them. I mean, when Michael Eckenfels was doing one of those campaigns, he was writing it up in the forums. He actually named all the crew members after other people in the forums. So, we had Vance is the tail gunner or whatever Vance was doing. I that for sure. But we had those guys in the crew. And so that was kind of cool. But I don't remember if there's an explicit thing in the rules for those that the accumulated experience and knowledge and increase in ability carries over from game to game. I know it does in The Hunters, as you mentioned, the U-boat series of games like that. Both Hunters and Hunted, right? Got them on either side of the battle.
Well, Hunters and Hunted are both U-boats. Silent Victory is the Allied one where you're playing an Allied submarine.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I had it backwards there. The other one that's not an historical game that I can think of where it's easy to do that is Battletech, because you've got your individual pilots in the mechs before the Mech Warrior game was ever even released. You still had your individual pilots in the mechs that you could switch and swap out. And it was very easy to house rule that, you know, okay, if they survive two battles, then you can give them a plus one to any one stat and just sort of throw it on there. And it was very easy to house rule a rudimentary experience level into there.
Yeah. And that was something that was brought in directly into the Battletech game was campaign rules for that later on too.
Yeah. Yeah. And really what the Mech Warrior rules did was not necessarily, I mean, to an extent, they codified a lot of those house ruled pieces of here's how to have your mech pilots get better at being, you know, in the cockpit. But really what the Mech Warrior rules gave you was, it was rules to adjudicate everything outside the mech, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because the Battletech game itself was built around giant battling robots, right? It wasn't, they couldn't give a crap less what happened once you got out of the cockpit. The Mech Warrior rules gave you the ability to deal with all the rest of that stuff. But Battletech was a very easy one, in part because there's the game is built around that one-to-one analog, right? You have that mech with that dude in it and you're doing your thing with him. So that was a very easy one-to-one that didn't exist in pick a Normandy game, right? You know what I mean?
I've never played Battletech, but it kind of sounds like, we'll talk about Traveler again. Why not? But Traveler has the, what are you doing in your downtime? How are you going to improve yourself type thing? Is that what was going on in what you're talking about, Brent?
Not exactly. So Battletech, the actual Battletech board game is built around mech combat, right? You've got these giant, 100-foot tall walk and they look like robots, but there's actually a human pilot sitting in there.
Right.
And so they're off having their big old fight. And then later rules introduced things like tanks and infantry and aircraft and all the other stuff. So you could fight actual combined arms stuff. Then you could fight the planetary invasions. You could fight the outer space dogfighting combat that looked like Star Wars kind of stuff. You know, they grafted all those other things on there. But the core of the game was still a whole bunch of these giant battling robots walking around on terrain beating each other up. And it's a one-to-one scale, right? You got one dude inside that Phoenix Hawk shooting the one dude inside the Warhammer across the battle. Actually, the Phoenix Hawk's probably running away from the Warhammer class mech, but you get my point. you hope so. And so you have the individual pilots in there and the Battletech game handled all of the stuff that happened on the battlefield, right? Running around, shooting each other, blowing each other up. The part that you're talking about, that whole, what do you do in your downtime? What do you do when you're not blowing up other mechs, was all of the stuff that went into the Mech Warrior game. What do you do when you're, you know, sneaking and creeping through some espionage mission somewhere? What do you do when you're negotiating for travel off the planet because your employer, you know, bailed out on you and left you there as a mercenary? Now you got to find your way off planet. Like all of those other interactions were what went into the Mech Warrior RPG, which was 7 or 8 years after the. So there was originally Battle Droids, then there was Battletech, and I think Mech Warrior came out concurrent with Battletech second edition or really close. Gary, you might remember. I think they were within a year.
That sounds approximately correct. What about Combots? Yeah. You remember that?
Yes.
I think that was, I mean, I'm remembering that was FASA too. I could be wrong about that.
It was, and Combots predates Mech Warrior or the Mech Warrior RPG, if I recall correctly.
It predates everything. Okay.
I don't know that it predates Battle Droids, but it might. It may be close.
I'd have to check. It feels like it did, but I mean, we're reaching back into the dim mists of prehistory at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know that it's a true statement that half of our audience wasn't necessarily born when all of that was happening, just because we're war gamers. But, you know, easily 2/3 of the current tabletop gaming audience in the large was not yet born when these events were happening.
Oh, I'm not even kidding when I say I have dice older than those people.
Oh yeah.
I think we all do.
We did a whole podcast about dice older than those people.
Yeah.
I have shoes older than those people. Okay.
We did not do a podcast about shoes older than those people.
So that's an interesting point, though. The sort of, you know, you have your board game play, and then you have some other mechanism that handles all the stuff that happens between sessions of board game play. And that brings to mind a parallel that we've seen in RPGs now with the One Ring is in the news again because there's a current Kickstarter that took 4 minutes to fund. The One Ring RPG is it's a Lord of the Rings RPG, and it's kind of set in the period between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and it introduces this thing called this is not a new mechanism to the One Ring, it's just topical right now. So you have an adventure, and then you have another adventure, and you have another adventure, and then you have what's called a fellowship phase, which is kind of what you're doing in the off season. It's like this downtime activity. And in the One Ring, you can do things like, I will go visit Elrond as is my fellowship activity, or I will compose a song about the grief of the elves, or, you know, whatever. Pendragon, the old King Arthur Pendragon game from Chaosium and other publishers, had a very similar thing where there was a winter phase in which you would manage your fief because the player characters were all nobles. Ars Magica has kind of built-in covenant management things where you're encouraged to structure it in that way, where you have a story that you go and do with characters, and then some time passes during which you use this sort of strategic game element to work on the covenant.
Doesn't Forbidden Lands also have this stronghold thing where you know you're not out doing whatever, you're building up your stronghold?
Yes, it does.
Yes, there's a certain level you got to get to before it kicks in Forbidden Lands, but
yeah. It's old school D&D in that respect, except that there's an actual mechanism to deal with that, which there really never was in old school D&D.
Yeah.
In first edition AD&D, they described, you know, once you hit ninth level, you could go build a stronghold and attract some retainers and whatever else.
Yeah.
But aside from like giving you some castle construction costs, sort of left it up to the DM to fake it. With the companion rules for the Beckme system, there were actual rules for stronghold management that got put in place. Some of those things got carried forward, and some of those concepts, not the exact rules, some of those concepts got carried forward in the second edition, but not to a great extent, really, until Birthright showed up.
They were always
there, but they were a secondary sort of thing.
Yeah, it was in Birthright that those concepts were brought to maturity in D&D specifically.
Yes.
And then when second edition went away and we went to third edition and then 3.5, there were various third party efforts to try and bring that aspect back with what gets called in role playing circles domain management gameplay, which is probably not a great name for it, but the sort of kingdom running background that can exist in an RPG. There are people who, including me, who really like that type of gameplay element.
It can be, and domain management is a perfect academic term in that it is technically accurate and boring as hell.
Yeah, and there's at least two separate Traveler books dealing with that topic as well. One for fourth edition and one for Mongoose Traveler first edition.
Yeah.
Also, Mutant Year Zero has the, you build up your arc. Your arc actually gains levels. You need more food. You need water. So, and it kind of generates missions based on your need of, what you need to survive, which is
that's cool. Typically the driver of that. It's that, we did Ars Magica was our like main RPG for like a decade. And, that's exactly how those, stories arose, is there would be some kind of complication that arose in the covenant management part of things. It's like, we don't have this book. We desperately need this particular magical spell. We need to develop this particular magical spell to meet some other need, but we don't have a book about it. Nobody knows enough to do this. So we now have to go out, venture forth and go find books or go find a mentor to teach them this particular magical art or whatever.
Yeah.
So swinging this back around to we've got a war game on the table and we're looking for where different kinds of RPG elements kind of fit into some of those things. We've sort of covered that one-to-one, like the single man counter, the single character represented on the map. That's a fairly easy one to handle. The next level up, though, once you start kind of echeloning your way up, the the Lock and Load tactical game has squad level counters, individual vehicles, but squad level counters, has leaders, much like Squad Leader does, but also has the heroes mechanism running around where you're going to generate some heroes on the battlefield. But again, one of the things I don't recall ever explicitly seeing a Lock and Load tactical series of chained scenarios that carries heroes over from one to the other. Somebody may have house ruled some of these. Some of them may exist in some of the more recent Lock and Load releases since Dave's taken the company. I don't have all of those. I've only got like two of them. And so I wouldn't want to say that these don't appear anywhere because somebody will send us an email and go, no, page 68 of Heroes Against the Red Star. There they are. So it's possible they're out there. But that's I think that would be a very easy game in which to graft on some slight RPG elements to that. You've got these heroes that were generated in this battle, and now that hero sort of carries forward because he's already on the map for the next game. What do you guys think? Hey, Gary, I don't know how much familiarity you have with the Lock and Load tactical system there.
Yeah, I've played it a couple of times. I mean, there have been I'm going to like reframe this in ASL terms because I've seen people do this something similar with ASL as well in terms of a campaign building type of thing where you build in leader improvement rules and your leaders can improve over the course of a lengthy campaign. So I've seen that. I can't really speak to Lock and Load Tactical per se, because I've never been that into Lock and Load Tactical. I mean, I've played it like twice is the limit of my Lock and Load Tactical experience.
Okay. But you know, even just that sort of house ruling of leaders can improve over time, I mean, that's an RPG element that you're grafting into.
Sure.
You know, what is some would consider the archetypal war game there. And so, you know, whether you're just using the funny German accent for, you know, the German leader as he's getting better through the battles, but, you know, the ability to get better throughout the course of the game, I think that's kind of, you know, exactly the sort of RPG piece you might want to put on something like that. Mike, any experience with something similar in any of the, I know you've done a whole bunch of different lower scale war games lately. What do you think?
I'm trying to think of anything like that where, like you say, where you have either a hero or a leader or a group squaddies even that actually carry over or continue on. And I can't think of a single one.
Yeah.
Lock and Load Tactical. I know you generate the heroes, but I do not remember them saying, oh yeah, you know, if this guy's, you create this scenario, then he moves on to the next one. I don't think they have that.
As we start looking at other leaders present in different games, because that's obviously the easiest place to kind of inject some role-playing elements in there. Mike, a couple of years ago at Origins, you had the 54mm Roman soldiers floating around on your map there. Were those there for individual leaders, or were those just, you wanted some cool markers on the map?
I think it was just bling on the map at that point, but certainly they could have been used for that, you know? might not have been a bad idea.
Yeah. So Liberty or Death has specific stands for the commanders. I love one of them in Liberty or Death because you have the Indian chief Joseph Brandt. And so there's actually a stand up command figure in a war game with my name on it. It says Brandt on there. Great.
But you know, and earlier you were talking, I mean, this does kind of, you know, merge into what we were talking about on another podcast with the game modifications, you know, where you have cubes on the board and, you know, you want more to immersion. So you go out and get figures and actually replace the cubes with figures, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you're kind of sort of in the same area.
Next thing you know, you're buying miniatures. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh God. No, 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 no.
Or you're doing what Cyrano does these days, right? Osarsky just opens up Tabletop Simulator and copy paste. Suddenly you've got the French army, right?
Well, it beats dealing with miniatures.
Oh God, yes.
but I will say, and I'm going to get on the solo soapbox here for a second, as a someone who plays a lot of solitaire war games, you're more apt to roleplay than I think someone who plays with a group of people. So when I sit down and play Blitz by myself, you know, I'm gonna play the Germans like I think the Germans would play, and then I'm gonna put on another hat and I'm gonna become, you know, the allies and play like I think they would play. So there's certainly role playing going on there. And I think when you play a solo game, you kind of have to.
Yeah, that's probably a true statement. Gary, what do you think? Do you intentionally try to inhabit the characteristics of whoever it is you're playing?
Not really, no. In terms of hamming it up, yeah, I've been known to do that, but I never like try and internalize the national character of a faction that I'm trying to play. I'm usually more concerned about getting the rules right and not boobing up the actual execution of the gameplay than I am about that.
Yeah, one of the points that springs to mind coming back to that, Mike, what you were talking about is one of the lessons that we were taught. This is going back 25 years now, right? In our Armor Officer Basic course, when we were talking about Russian doctrine, Russian tactics, and I've heard this from other places as well, but we heard it specifically in that Op4 threat class, and that is there are certain ways in which Russian operations happen that are different than what the U.S. would try to do, and so you can't apply a U.S. mindset to what the Russians are doing. The example they would always give is you've got the Russian left, right, the left, center, and right of the battle are going, you know, are going on there, and the left side is slowly weakening. It's holding for now, but it appears to be weakening. The center is making progress, but it is slow progress. And the right side is just completely falling apart and looks like, you know, the troops over there are about to get routed. Where do you commit your reserve? And there are, you know, there's three different answers, obviously, that are available there. The Russian answer is you commit them to the center. The Russians would, you know, the thing that's ingrained in them from the start is always you reinforce success. It doesn't matter how small the success is. That's what you reinforce. That's what we were taught. How true that is versus propaganda, I don't know. I just know that's what we were taught, but it's something that I've read elsewhere and seen elsewhere. So I'm, you know, having confirmation of it from multiple sources, I'm going to run with it. So is that a place where you might think, oh, that's how a Russian would do things, not that's how an American playing the Russian things. This is what I should be doing. And you know, even though the smarter move to try to win the game might be something different based on victory conditions, whatever it may be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not going to play every game like that. Don't get me wrong. There's some games, you know, you want to, I think you kind of, some games I'll play just to kind of play around with the historical outcome, you know, what if this had gone this way instead? So, and then those, when you do like that, you're not really role playing, I guess. You're just kind of trying out new things. But there are games, I think, where I think you do want to do some role playing. And, you know, if I'm playing Blitz and I start off as Germany, I don't want to try to make peace with France right off, right? It's just, doesn't make any sense. I've been again, maybe it bastards. Does. Maybe it does because you're role playing something different. I don't know. But yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Gary, what do you think?
Well, actually, that makes me think, turn the question around and ask, where do we say something like the national security decision-making game, which what you're talking about reminds me of, and which I've done, fits on this kind of spectrum. I mean, I sort of one-third jokingly referred to it in the past as LARPs for wargamers. You're encouraged.
That's not joking.
You're encouraged to think in those terms in NSDM, right? In terms of you're given briefing materials to make that easier, to encourage you to think in terms of, you know, from the perspective of, you know, Soviet members of the Politburo or the Iranian oil minister or what have you, depending on whatever this scenario is. So I think that can be an approach that you take. I suspect, though, that the more structured the game system itself is, the less likely you will be to do that. Just from game mechanics standpoint, it's very easy to do that in NSDM because the rules are basically completely invisible to the players. They are heavily refereed and there's some stuff going on in the background, but basically it's an improv type of thing.
It's like Whose Line Is It Anyway, right? It's all made up and the points don't matter.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the rules will over, like even in Blitz, I think you start off at war with France, as Germany, so I don't think you could try to make peace. But you know, another place, Brant, is at Origins when we do the command post exercise. you can't tell me there's not role playing going on there.
Sure.
Because I mean, those guys, they actually adapt. I mean, it's almost stressful to be in those situations because you've got the intel guy, you've got the, you know, the air guy, and it's just, it's, tell me they're not role playing.
I wasn't going to bring it up. I was waiting for you guys to bring it up.
Tell me that's not role playing.
Gary, what was the role you were inhabiting in the ones you've done?
Yeah, the NSDM game I did, we did the memorable one was we were actually Cold War era Soviet politicians. and the whoever was in charge was just removed, and you know, there was that jostling for position that we historically saw when, say, somebody like Brezhnev passed to see who was going to end up on top. I ended up on top.
There you go.
So
what position did you have in the command post exercise?
I forget. I think I've done it twice, and I've done different roles both times, and I don't remember the roles specifically. What I took away from it was more the overall experience, rather than my specific responsibilities, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I I've coached those a bunch. I've not played in the command post exercises because I'm always coaching or organizing or something else. But the flip side of it is I don't need to play in the command post exercises. You know, I kind of did it for real for a couple of years. I got a sense of what those things look like. With actual logistics play, not, you know, hand waved computer logistics play. So I've done a bunch of those kinds of exercises for real on top of the coach and the CPXs. Mike, you're exactly right. That is, you know, role-playing in a military game, but that's, you know, that is grafting the role-playing component in that whole planning piece well before the execution. Because, I mean, we're using a commercial off-the-shelf war game, right? We're using Flashpoint campaigns. You can go to the Matrix store right now and buy Flashpoint campaigns and buy the exact game that we use for the command post exercises. The difference is the guys we have pushing buttons at the CPX are the guys that design the game. Right? Yeah. We have the on-target sims guys show up and they handle the computer piece for us. So that you guys don't have to touch the computer. There's no knowledge needed of how to make the game go in order to play in those things.
They are the game masters. That's true.
Yeah. for the folks that haven't heard us talk about these things on the podcast before, the command post exercises are the best way to describe it. It's a team event, but you are the command post for a unit that is going through the battle in near real time. It's not, we slow it down slightly because otherwise it's going to be over way too quick, but you start with, here is your mission. Here are your available forces. Here's the map you're going to be fighting on. We give everybody different roles. So there's a commander and an executive officer and a plans guy and an intel guy and a fires guy and a logistics guy and an aviation guy. And so we give people different roles within that staff. And the commander and the XO together have to work with the staff to formulate the plan. This is what we think the bad guys are going to do. This is what our mission is. Here's how we want to accomplish our mission while thwarting the bad guys. You put the whole plan together. Our guys that are operating the computer will program what you've given us for the plan for the friendly units to actually do their thing. And then we flip the game on and go. And at, you know, after turn one, when your plan's already gone to crap, after turn one, we look at the commander and we go, all right, boss, now what? And the commander's got to work with the staff to adjust the plan in real time as the battle unfolds. And that's what we're doing with the command post exercises. I mean, it's a little more than that, but that's what do you guys think? That, Gary, is that about right?
Yeah, you're not quite selling the level of player disorganization that occurs during this exercise, but yeah.
I don't want to scare them off before they ever get it. I, at this point, I still want them to think, wow, that's cool. And
it is awesome. It's awesome. But part of the reason it's awesome is because it shows you the difficulties of that level of command coordination and why you have to have highly trained people doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we've done these in a variety of contexts over the years. The last several years, the last, I don't know, 8-9 years now, we've used the Flashpoint campaign series games again, because we have the game operators, the game designers, the developers there to help as a part of our team and our staff. And it helps that some of that team also have along list of military experience behind it as well. So we've got a former division master gunner who's worked in division CPs and battalion CPs there helping coach as well. But in the past, we've done Battle of the Bulge, both the German side and the Allied side. We've done the German invasion of the Balkans, and so we've done a German battle through Greece where the Germans are attacking the Brits in Greece. We did a naval game one year. We did Persian incursion one time, which was a lot of fun. We've done a couple of different things over the years besides just Flashpoint campaigns. We've just kind of settled on that one lately, just having the dudes there to help make those go. We did Decisive Action one year. That was a mistake. That game is way too complicated for that level. Decisive Action is the commercially available version of the division level sim that they actually use at the Command and General Staff College for training division level plans and exercises. And so there's some things that are nerfed out just to make it more commercially viable, but it's way more complicated than most crews are going to be able to really.
And where can I get this?
I think it's HPSMs sells the stuff. I'm not sure, but it's a pretty detailed one, pretty complicated one. We tried Close Combat one time, one of the Close Combat games. The problem with the Close Combat games is because they run in real time, what we ended up with was 8 different people all staring at their computer screens and not interacting with each other at all. So that one didn't really accomplish what we were after. The command post exercises work best when none of the players are looking at a computer screen, when everybody's around the map and then maybe watching the monitor as the battle unfolds just to know what the outcomes are, but not trying to operate a computer, obviously. That's when they tend to work best.
That's even true, I think, with Jim's Kriegsville. When you watch those guys do it physically in person, it's a totally different experience than watching them play in Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the online Kriegsvilles are, you know, completely opaque until until you get to the AARs, just because the whole point is for nobody to be talking to each other unless they're right in front of each other, and then it's still being mediated through the command exercise group there. The best analog that others have used for the command post exercises that some of the non-wargaming audience might know is the Artemis Bridge Simulator, which is it's the, you know, air quote Star Trek Bridge Simulator. Like, they don't have the rights to call it Star
All
Trek.
All of the serial numbers have been thoroughly
exactly.
Yes.
However, that's totally what it is. Anybody listening that hasn't done that gets to go to a hypothetical convention in a hypothetical future where we have conventions again. Even like board game conventions tend to have this thing. It's the Artemis Spaceship Bridge Simulator, and it is an absolute scream. And I would encourage anybody to participate in it.
Yeah,
if you can.
Yeah,
and which you probably can't.
Well, and that's not a war game, but that is
no.
It's a LARP thing.
Oh, yeah, but you know, actually that's a good point. It totally has war game elements. I mean, you're playing this sort of tactical video game type of thing, right? But it also has role playing elements. Who is going to play the engineering officer and not say, "I'm giving the role she's got, Captain"? Who's going to that person does not exist.
Yeah. Probably not. The issue with the Artemis Bridge Simulator, though, is that it doesn't necessarily have to be a combat scenario. It can be an exploration scenario. It can be a diplomatic scenario. It can be a couple of different. It's usually a combat scenario simply because the immediacy of combat sort of forces everybody to react to things a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be. It can be an emergency evacuation scenario, get people off the planet before it blows up kind of
That's
thing.
That's awesome, but I didn't know that. I've never seen it or done it in anything but a shoot stuff scenario or we are being shot at.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many of those scenarios they have preset or scripted for the Artemis Bridge team, right? I don't know what they're prepared to execute, but the way the team is structured and the way the environment is structured, it doesn't have to be a shooting scenario.
Okay.
You can do other things. The command post exercises, it's tough to do those and not be a shooting scenario. because if it's not a shooting scenario, then you're playing Aftermath and you're doing a post-earthquake, you know, emergency response kind of scenario. And that's really because, again, if you're doing a military unit, you're there to blow stuff up, right? That's the point of sending 11th ACR to the inner German border in 1985, right? To shoot and get shot at. That's why you're there. The Artemis spaceship, you might send to do other things.
In theory.
In theory.
It's a little harder to sell. I'll definitely agree with that.
Yeah, I'm not going to discount that at all. Again, the sexiness of it is you get to blow shit up in space. Right? I mean, that's the easy sell. But there's nothing inherent in the existence of a crew on the bridge of a spaceship that says you have to go shoot stuff. That is very different than the situation we have at the command post exercises, where you are the command group of a U.S. Army line battalion and your job is to go blow shit up. Like, that's mm-hmm. your only purpose. So there are some slight differences for what that, you know, in SDM, it may be that your goal is to not let things get blown up. Right? That might be that's
definitely true.
So the intent might be to keep things. So the, you know, again, just looking at places where you could inject role playing into wargaming. And so that's, you know, I think the CPXs are definitely one of those things that. Out of curiosity, thinking of some digital games, are there digital ones you guys can think of that have any sort of role-playing element that can be brought into digital wargaming, if any? Mike, can you think of any?
There's got to be, because when you get into the computer, you know, there, I think there you do start seeing more games where you have units gain experience and, you know, they progress on into better units. I'm trying to think of a war game though that's like that. See, I said now I can't think of an example.
Well, Hearts of Iron does that. I mean, your units gain combat experience as you use them. I'm talking about Hearts of Iron 3. I don't know if Hearts of Iron 4 has this feature or not.
Yeah.
There is a progression thing. Your leaders can also improve over the course of time, again, as they are used.
Yeah. So the one that I'm thinking of, there's actually kind of does several of those things as you're describing, Gary. VR Designs has the mobile for the mobile interface. They've got the Small General series. There's just a generic Small General one. There's also a Barbarossa one. Or an East Front. I think it's the Barbarossa scenario, but I think it's Small General Eastern Front. There's a couple of those where units will change capability as they survive combat and get reconstituted. That they do maintain some enhanced ability as they play along. VR Designs also has they've got on the computer. They've got an East Front game where there's a significant personality management element to the whole game, that you've got your different subordinate leaders that all have their own agendas as a part of that. And so you as the commander are not just moving troops around and keeping some logistics flowing, but you've also got to manage the commanders in the right places so that you don't have two guys that absolutely hate each other trying to fight the same battle together because they're not going to coordinate properly. That you don't have some incompetent twat managing your logistics for you because everybody up front's going to run out of fuel. That you don't have the equivalent of a Mark Clark running off and attacking the wrong city instead of, you know, doing what he was told. You've got all of these different personalities that you have to manage as a part of it. And that made for an interesting second level of depth of gameplay beyond just, let me move a bunch of icons around a map and blow stuff up. So that got a little interesting.
There was the old computer game, No Greater Glory, Civil War game, that you actually had to keep, I think it was states, if I'm remembering correctly, this is so long ago, that you had to keep the state senators happy. They would have demands once in a while that they wanted, you know, something to happen. And you had to sit there and think, well, do I want to do that? Because it's going to screw up my my war planning. Or do I want to, you know, make the senator happy? And
yeah. So. Gary, I know you're far more of a tabletop RPG dude than a digital guy. I didn't know if there were any digital ones popping to mind for you.
No, not really. I mean, I'm going to be, I guess, pedantic about it and make the statement that there is no such thing as a video game role-playing game. That the features that I'll be more specific and say that the features that I expect out of an RPG don't really exist in video games. Certainly you can have video games with appealing stories. There's plenty of examples. You certainly have, you know, what get called RPGs, which really only have the progression element of RPGs in them, if that, but usually they do. I mean, the closest thing I would say I've played to a real RPG that's also a video game is probably the Mass Effect games, because you do have some choices that do then impact the storyline in certain restricted ways. Yeah. But I will, you know, happily admit to being a snob about this too, as always.
Yeah. And probably not unrealistically, right? I mean, that's a fair statement for the way most people conceptualize RPGs. And I think really what you're describing, though, when you're talking about computer game RPG, you're talking about playing against an AI, because if there's, you know, if we're sitting around Roll 20 on a tabletop, we've got a computer mediating an actual RPG, right? You're not talking about something like that.
Correct. Yeah. So that is a different situation. And it's not about the computer managing the combat, which in principle is totally fine. It's that the computer is also, when the computer is also managing the story instead of like a human, then you are, you know, restricted to the story that was written by the game's developers. There is such a thing as, you know, this is a whole, you know, as somebody that got into the weeds in this in video games for quite a while, there is such a thing as emergent gameplay in video games. It tends to happen in multiplayer games, but I've seen it happen even in single player games too. In Skyrim, for example, you could see elements of emergent gameplay that happen, but they're few and far between and not to the same degree that you would be able to introduce into a game that was being run by a human referee.
Yeah, because there's, you know, the computer only has what it's programmed to react with as its universe of options to react to you.
Right.
So.
Yeah, but, you know, you might be surprised at what the computer can do. So, you know, very brief Skyrim story here. I'm fighting this guy in Skyrim. He runs away. I start chasing him. I get slowed down for some reason. I'm running down the road looking for this guy, and I find that he is there. I see him up ahead, and he's being mauled by a bear that just happened to be wandering by, which was awesome. It's an unusual occurrence when you're able to see that kind of thing emerge from the world that the game has established. That happens way less frequently than I would like to see in computer, quote unquote, air quote, RPG.
Yeah, like you said, that's almost impossible to do.
I have to ask, in your Skyrim game, did you take an arrow to the knee?
Oh, many times, I'm sure. But I was usually the one shooting other people in the knee, so...
There you go. That was just always the classic Skyrim quote, right? I used to be an adventurer like you until I took an arrow to the knee.
It, with the dime store Arnold Schwarzenegger accent, no less. Yeah.
Which I'm not even going to try to do. There are limits to how role-playing-ish I'm going to get.
Perhaps you think I haven't played entire campaigns using a voice exactly like this. You would be mistaken.
And yes, Dime Store Schwarzenegger accent. There you are. What ground haven't we covered here yet, guys? What, Gary, is there a part of the RPG war game intersection, leaving aside the idea of military themed RPGs, right? Because we sort of ruled those out at the start.
Yeah. But
of RPG elements in war games. What haven't we covered that we should have?
No, I think we've covered all of the major points of contact. There aren't, I guess in closing, maybe we mentioned that there really aren't all that many military themed RPGs, although there's a few. Like I said, we mentioned a couple of them. There's Recon and Behind Enemy Lines and a couple other ones. And if you're a GURPS fan, I don't know anybody that actually did anything like this. You could play it like a Napoleonic era GURPS game if you wanted to.
There are the Weird Wars games. There's Gearkrieg.
Yeah.
Although Gearkrieg's more of a minis game, it's not hard to graft some RPG rules onto it.
No, that's true. CQK
obviously is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and now is coming back. Like, we're all supposed to be getting our T2K shipments sometime this summer. Phoenix Command.
Perhaps you ordered that.
Mike and I both did.
No, I didn't order that one.
I thought you did. I thought you jumped on T2K.
Yeah, I talked myself out of it.
No, I talked myself into it. It didn't take long.
That's a good example that I didn't even think to mention. I've actually never played T2K. We're talking about Twilight 2000, of course.
Correct.
I felt like I owned it at various times, and I actually still might have a copy of the main book. I felt like the lighter system that they were going to use in this version of it was going to be a bad fit for the traditional Twilight 2000 target audience. Yeah. Much, much less simulation-y than what we would be used to from the old style Traveler 2000 system.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean it's bad. It just didn't ring my bell for whatever reason at that exact time.
I went ahead and jumped on it as much for the nostalgia factors and anything else. And I have no doubt that I'm going to read it all cover to cover and never play it.
It's going to be a hex crawl type of game too, just like Forbidden Lands.
Correct. Yeah.
That sounds great.
There was also just, you know, running through some of them. There was Phoenix Command for people that think, you know, slide rules and spreadsheets are cool as a part of a role-playing game. You want to talk about bullet level simulation mechanics.
Yeah. Insane. Yeah, I'd never played that, obviously. I'm not sure anybody ever did.
I tried once.
You know, I am somebody that has actually tried to play games that people never try to play, like the fantasy wargaming, the Bruce Galloway fantasy wargaming system. I tried to play that. It did not go well.
You probably got as far as I did when I tried
After
it.
Years of study, I think I managed to make a character that sort of made sense, and that's about as far as I got. I mean, I've played Powers and Peril. I ran Dangerous Journeys for 3 years, actually. So, you know, I've got as varied a role-playing resume as you'd want. Nevertheless, I've really ever done much with military role playing where you're actually playing the members of a military unit. I have seen that happen. I mean, I've heard of that type of gameplay happen a lot, but usually it's not in the context of a dedicated thing, right? It's like it's a traveler campaign and you're a mercenary company. That's a very common campaign type. It's a fantasy game and you're a mercenary company like the Black Company. There's a whole game for that, by the way, called Band of Blades. It's a similar system to the Blades in the Dark series. Basically, you're fantasy mercenary unit in a dark fantasy world, a la the Black Company or the Steven Erikson Malazan books. But I've never played Recon, never played against Behind Enemy Lines. That Red Dawn RPG. It wasn't called that, of course, but it was basically Red Dawn, the RPG, back in the day that I could picture the cover. And I cannot name the game off the top of my head.
I know the one you're thinking of, and I, like you, I am stuck for the title. There were a variety of the military ones, and obviously, look, with my background, and I, you know, mentioned it before, growing up in Europe, grew up in the military, son of an army officer, was in the army for a while myself. Like, the military theme ones were always ones that were going to attract my interest, and T2K especially. You want to talk about something that hits close to home? These are American units stuck overseas in Germany. It was released while I was living in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sort of, you know, I'm reading these things and I'm going, yeah, well, that's kind of realistic, you know, like,
yeah, it's like, hey, this module is set right over there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like you can open up some of the maps and use them to drive around town. You know, there's sort of that level detail, which on one hand is kind of cool. On the other hand, is a little freaky. You're like talking about, you know, this post-apocalyptic wasteland in a town you're busy trying to drive through. And so that's a little weird. So T2K for me, again, the nostalgia effect of all of that is very different for someone like me than it is for most average role players. And that's fine. Like, I know I'm an outlier and okay, fine. I'll get over it. I will tell you that one of the biggest challenges you run into with a lot of the military RPGs is the idea that unless you are dealing with something like Behind Enemy Lines, where it's a commando raid kind of thing or a long range patrol where you are obviously and intentionally separated from everybody else around, to put something in the true appropriate military context, that entire hierarchy around you and all of the adjacent military force around really takes a lot of the role-playing elements that we're used to away, because we're used to you're off wandering around doing whatever, and you, when you hit the crossroads, you have the choice of left or right or go straight or whatever. In a traditional role-playing game, if you're doing things appropriate within a military game, you already know before you get to the crossroads which way you're supposed to turn, because if you turn the other way, now there's a gap in the line, right? And then now, mm-hmm. now the rest of your unit's getting screwed because you just opened up a hole that the enemy gets to drive right through. And so there are very specific prescriptive places where you have to go and do certain things because that's the way the order's written. And so unless you're on some sort of deep recon patrol where it's the five of you against the world, you know, you're in the Highlands in Vietnam or whatever, it's you know, it's tough to build a satisfying role-playing campaign out of your squad of grunts invading the beach in Norm, right? You're surrounded by 150,000 other people trying to get off the beach.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that that would get... I would think that that would get fairly repetitive unless you moved away from the core concept relatively quickly, which you could, right? If especially in a post-apocalyptic type of setting, you could easily end up with your player group sets themselves up as warlords in, you know, Poland or something like that. You could totally do that, but then that's quite a different game, right? Outside the military command structure that you started the game with.
And that was exactly the point of T2K. Mm-hmm. Originally was get back to Bremerhaven, you're on your own, see you there, hope you make it to the ship. And so you were intentionally left on your own with the breakdown in military hierarchy that you did have to sort of get back across the continent on mm-hmm. your own. That was the underlying shtick of it, is that the rest of that stuff doesn't exist anymore because of the breakdown over the course of the 5 years of war. Mm-hmm. So that was built in, that was totally baked in from the start in the T2K concept. You know, for a lot of us, the military kids growing up, we were looking at those military themed RPGs in part because we kind of wanted to see how our reality was being reflected in those role playing games, which was something we were interested in. We were obviously interested in a lot of the weapons and stats and, you know, a lot of the numerical components of things, because, you know, gun looks kind of cool. I want to know what it does. Yeah, exactly. The gearhead stuff. And to an extent, we wanted to see how well the writers sort of got it right based on what we had experienced, you know, around our own military settings. And again, look, I was a kid growing up in the military, but there were 25-year-olds stationed in Europe at the time that were buying these games also, and that were playing these games as well. And so, you know, it's not like it was just the kids running around doing this. That said, I don't know how many of those things got played to a great level of detail besides some occasional one shots. I don't know a ton of military folks that spend a lot of time playing the military RPGs. And I don't know how much of that was, we just didn't want to take work home with us. And, you know, let's do this for fun, or how much of it was, we didn't think it was appropriately reflective of what it should have been, or how much of it was, we just wanted to do something different. You know, that's just, again, my experience, but my experience over, you know, a wide swath of time being around the military. So one thing, just looking at the shelf and thinking of T2K, there was an actual T2K war game released that was The Last Battle. It was a simplified version of GDW's First Battle mechanics, but that was an actual combat resolution as a role-playing game for T2K that really was kind of there so vehicle combat made more sense, I think, more than anything else. Gary, did you ever see The Last Battle, play it?
Was that what it was called, was The Last Battle?
Yeah, it was called The Last Battle.
No, I don't think I did. I don't think that's a product that I remember, actually.
Okay. So GDW had the First Battle series of games that was...
I remember.
It was the branded Team Yankee and then Battlefield Europe and Test of Arms, which were the generic sets of counters and lots of wacky scenarios in there, right? Like the Belgian Civil War kind of stuff. But then there was the Last Battle was the T2K, air quote, war game, right? It was sort of the war game resolution for T2K.
I've seen this cover. I'm looking at it now. I've seen this cover. I did not realize that that's what this was.
Yeah, that's what it was. That was the T2K game. And really, I think the reason it existed was to make vehicle combat makes sense on the tabletop, because a lot of, yes, you can put individual people on a grid or hex grid, square grid, doesn't matter, in order to do all the math that you want to do for combat, if that's what you want, as opposed to the theater of the mind of, yeah, you're close enough to punch him, no, you got to step back and shoot him, whatever. You know, we're used to describing those things in a role-playing game at the man-to-man level, but as soon as you start putting vehicles out there, now all of a sudden people have a harder time conceptualizing it, and that's where the war game came in more, running the vehicles around. And I really think that was more the point of it. I'm sure somebody from GDW sent us a nastygram and go, no, you've completely missed the point.
possibly.
Yeah. like anybody from GDW is listening to us. I'd be over the moon if they were. Look, I'd be thrilled to get an email from them telling us how wrong we are, because that means they're listening, and that would be kind of cool.
So it's funny that one of the guys I'm talking to behind the scenes on a little something is actually also talking behind the scenes to one of the old guys from GDW. So some of those,
great.
And it's not Frank or anybody like that, but it's a name you'd recognize, and it's like, oh, really? He's still involved. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. So that is another place where there was a very specific war game that grew out of an RPG. You know, we started off talking about how several of the old RPG modules were actual Hex Encounter war games. That's one where you got a boxed war game that belonged specifically to an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another place where you find those. Cool. I guess, you know, we're never going to run out of things to say, right? Not with us.
Oh, no.
but I think we may have hit a natural stopping point on this specific topic. And so, Mike, any parting thoughts on this at all? Anything you can think of there?
Just that I think you have two separate – it's interesting because there's people like us that I think love both role-playing games and war games, but they're just two almost separate groups. There's not a whole lot of overlap, and I don't think you're ever going to see that change. You might see it change a little bit, but it's not going to change a whole lot.
Okay. Gary?
I think he's right, but I think that's unfortunate because I am one of those people that is interested in the overlap.
Oh, yeah.
I'm interested in games with elements of both things. Not exclusively, of course, but that's an interest of mine, and I would like to see more topically, more treatment of the topic.
Yeah.
It has always been super niche. I mean, it's like you got two niches right off the top, and then you have like a smaller niche that's like in the other niches. So,
yeah.
You know, it's we're doomed here to be a really obscure area of interest.
And at a certain point, those domain management games, that almost becomes a 4X game where your role playing overlaps your war gaming, but at a certain point you're not permanently at war. There are other things you are doing, and at that point you're almost sort of 4X-ing it.
Yes.
Especially if you've been granted a piece of land by the king that you have to sort of go carve out your domain from whatever the locals are. I mean, at that point you're playing a 4X game that grew out of a role-playing wargaming hybrid. Now you're further niche-izing yourself, aren't you?
Sure. I mean, yeah. It's always been just a weird corner. That there's definitely been enough creative people that we continue to see support for it here and there, but it's never been, you know, a mainstream thing in either the role-playing or the wargaming world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see some one-off products for things here and there that fit into this niche. I don't know that anybody's going to, you know, make a living out of it, right? I don't know that the niche is big enough that anybody's going to be able to quit their job and pay their bills catering to the three of us and the 12 other people on the planet that care about
exactly
this, you know. So audience, definitely like let us know if you see some of these things, whether in the comments or in the forums or wherever. Definitely please let us know as these sort of cross your plate, cross your table. You don't want them crossing your plate as they cross your table, or as you unearth them from your shelves and go, oh yeah, I've got one of these. You know, let us know so that we can further educate ourselves. We do have a small bit of business we have to take care of. You know, again, we have our Patreon going, patreon.com/armchairdragoons. And one of the things that we've said is that folks that support us at a certain level, you get a shout out on the podcast by name. And so we've still got three folks that are supporting us at that level. And so Treb Curry and Kevin Bertram and Patrick Garrity, thank you very much from the bottom of our heart for supporting the Armchair Dragoons through our Patreon and helping keep us on the air and cranking forward with our website and keeping things going. For those of you curious about what this Patreon thing is, it's the a way in which you can sort of subscribe to the site to help support us financially, to help with our technology costs, our hosting costs, et cetera. And we have some occasional, you know, bonus content that we throw into the Patreon for those supporters. We had a couple of bonus questions with our David Thompson interview last week, as a for instance. By the time you're into this, that was about to go. we, for folks that support us at a certain level, we do a monthly social event right now because of COVID. We're doing sort of some online happy hours that you could take part in. And so if it's something that interests you, patreon.com/armchairdragoons, or just hit the link right there on the page with the podcast here. And Gary, you've got a Patreon for Ardwolf's Lair also, right?
Yes, I do. It is patreon.com/ArdWolf's Lair. And that's, of course, for the YouTube channel, which is at youtube.com/ArdWolf's Lair.
And so, you know, again, I guess for the foreseeable future, you're going to be live on Monday nights because now there's an expectation that you're there.
Yeah, it's become a popular thing. And I mean, you have as a somebody running a YouTube channel, you get access to like a certain amount of analytics from, you know, here's who's watching, and the numbers have like exploded since I started doing it. Views are up, like hours viewed, which is actually the more important statistic for YouTube, is up. Video engagement is up. You know, I had 72 people on last night. So at one point during the stream, so I am
one of them for a while there.
Yeah, just delighted that that folks want to stop by and hang around for a while. And you know what people a lot of times do is they listen to it the next day while they're at work or, you know, driving or, you know, in the shower or whatever, you know, whatever it is they do, cutting the grass. I think a buddy of mine texted me the other day and said he was listening to my stream while he was shoveling snow. So anyway, however,
What I do, so again, Monday nights, and I've mentioned this a couple of times on your broadcast, Monday nights I'm usually playing Soccer Taxi for my son, getting him to and from training. And so I'm listening to what I can around having to be in the car driving him around. But one of the things I do, so Tuesday, you know, I'm accumulating content for our Tuesday Newsday throughout the week. But on Tuesday mornings, I finalize that column that goes out each week, you know, our weekly whip around of the wargaming world. And so one of the things that I'll do a lot of times is as I'm going through all the different sites, double checking all the news that I might have missed during the week that I'm pulling in to finalize Tuesday Newsday, I frequently have your Monday counter clipping stream going in the background. And what I found is that I can do it on about 1.5%, 1.5x speed, and still catch everything that's being discussed. If I speed it up much more than that, I can't quite follow everything along, but at about 1.5 speed, I can catch it all. And then it doesn't take me 2.5 hours to get through it all.
It will not offend me if you listen to it at like 3x speed and I sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. I will
YouTube
not be offended.
Actually does a pretty good job of
it's,
modulating
it's,
the voice.
Yes, they
so
do.
That you don't sound like Alvin.
It's honestly, it's a bit disappointing.
Yeah. Fair enough. So yeah, definitely check out Gary on Monday nights and then the rest of the week. So Gary, I'm assuming that, you know, Monday night there's been a bit of a halo effect for the rest of the channel though, right? That,
oh yeah, yeah. I think so, yeah. I've got a sufficient amount of stuff going on in the background that is working its way toward release that some other things are taking a little bit of a back seat right now, including the Traveler Tuesday thing, which I had to actually got about 6 weeks in a row of releases on Tuesday with a Traveler video, but now we're actually working on a Traveler campaign. So that is taking up the time that would otherwise be going into making those videos.
Yeah. Yeah. So now that would make sense. And of course, you know, Gary always has something for us on Unboxing Day each month that he's unboxing a variety of stuff throughout the month anyway, but he always makes it a point to share one of those with us as well so that it can add Ardwolf to our Unboxing Day lineup. So if you miss those third Thursday of every month, we spend all day just unboxing stuff. And this past month we had 11 different somethings that we dug into, which is some old, some new, but always kind of fun to just to drop those throughout the day.
Hey, mine was like 11 years old, actually.
Yeah. So. Dude, I did a pair of SPI games from the 70s.
Yeah, nothing
wrong
with that.
I think the oldest thing I've ever done an unboxing of, now I will not do an unboxing of it. I might do a video on it, but I won't call it an unboxing unless I'm taking it out of the shrink wrap. I think the oldest thing I've done an unboxing video on was the Avalon Hill Source of the Nile. That sounds about right, which was from like 1979 or something like that.
Yeah, I pulled out two. So I have the Modern Battles quads complete in the flat packs, but I also had single copies of DMZ and Bundeswehr from Mod Quad 2, and that was what I had for Unboxing Day this past month and in February. And so I pulled out those two, and they're both unpunched. And so complete, intact, unpunched. Here you go. Here was here's two of the four games from Mod Quad 2 as individual games. And what's kind of fun is the DMZ one actually still has the old SPI mailback complaint card that if you had a problem with any of the
departments,
mail in the complaint. So
I always get a kick out of that, those, actually. It's like, oh, it'd be hilarious to send this in, right?
The funny thing is, one of the guys that used to get those was Brad Hessel, and he actually lives here in town. So
the
I could just walk it over to him.
I forget, it was it a Park Avenue address?
Might have been.
I think it was a. I mean, it was a, you know, a Manhattan address. I could tell you that. Presumably,
if I try to wheel across the road and if I try and wheel across the room and look, I'm going to pull myself out of my headset. So
it's all good. I don't have a SPI address handy either, but I think it was an address that we would associate today with being a very expensive location.
Yeah, hang on. Now you're making me wonder. I'm going to take the headset off for a second. We're doing this in real time, audience. Right? We're doing this without a net here.
Much more expensive freestyle podcasting. Much more expensive location than the Lake Geneva location. That was like Gary's house.
Yeah. Let's see. The one that I have, the SPI customer service department, was on East 23rd Street.
Okay.
That's the address on the complaint card that I've got here. I don't know if there's.
Maybe the complaints went to a different address. I don't know.
It could be. I'm looking to see. I don't see any other mailing address on like the rule sheets or anything. So I'm only looking at one thing, like DMZ is over there and it's not in a bag. So that's the one that I grabbed because I knew that's where the complaint card was. That emailed to 23rd Street in New York.
Yeah. I'm looking at one too, and it's got 23rd Street, New York.
Okay. So maybe not Park Avenue. Maybe Victory Games are the ones that got the Park
Avenue.
That
could be. That could be what I'm remembering. They may have had more than one address as well. I don't know.
Yeah, could be. I don't have any Victory games anywhere in reach that I would be able to look. So I'll have to defer to y'all. One of you guys can look it up and tell us all about it in the forums. So, audience, thank you very much for indulging us in this little bit of goofiness here at the end of the show. we appreciate you taking the trip with us through role-playing elements in war games, and hope you enjoyed it. And please sound off in the forums or sound off down below this episode. Love to hear your guys' thoughts on what you think about how role-playing elements can and should or shouldn't be incorporated in wargaming. And Mike, we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks. And Gary, I think we'll probably end up having you on at least one more time this season. Who knows?
Oh, that's fine.
Right? Twist your arm to talk about war games, huh?
Exactly. Because I don't spend enough time talking about war games already.
Well, we got to do something with Tuesday nights.
I am always delighted to be on.
Exactly.
And we're always delighted to have you. We're also delighted to have an audience, and we appreciate those guys. And so thank y'all very much. And we'll talk to everybody on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.
Everybody have a great
night. Good night.